The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, David Cameron's Scottish gamble, Braveheart or political folly? Could an early independence referendum come back to bite the government? Or could Alex Salmond's SNP be outmanoeuvred by Westminster? Also this week, the government suffers a triple defeat on welfare reform in the Lords. And the character thing, as political junkies head to their nearest multiplex for a fix of the Iron Lady, as I did last night, what does the example of Lady Thatcher tell us about political personality? And does a lack of it doom Labour's current attempt at a relaunch? Joining me for all of this we have the woman who some might style as the Guardian's own Iron Lady, Polly Toynbee, our columnist Martin Kettle, and fresh from Westminster, the SNP's chief whip, Stuart Hosey. A warm welcome to you all. Now, ever since Alex Salmond won that stunning election victory in Holyrood last year, one thing has been clear. Scotland will get the chance to vote on full independence from the United Kingdom. But the date, the format, and the wording of that referendum will be hotly contested, and many think it will prove crucial to the result. This week, David Cameron announced that Scotland could have its vote on independence, but only on his terms. At Prime Minister's Questions, Ed Miliband joined David Cameron in a rare united front.
Does the Prime Minister agree with me that we must make the case for the union, not simply against separatism, but the positive case about the shared benefits to us all of Scotland's part in the United Kingdom? The shared economic interests, the shared institutions like the NHS, our defence forces and the BBC, and above all, the shared values we hold together.
Well, I'm happy to say this is an area where the Right Honourable Gentleman and I are going to be in 100% agreement. I passionately believe in the future of our United Kingdom. I passionately believe we are stronger together rather than breaking apart. Frankly, I'm sad that we are even having this debate because I support the United Kingdom so strongly. But we have to respect the fact that Scotland voted for a separatist party at those Scottish parliamentary elections. So I think the first thing that's right to do is to make clear the legal position about a referendum. And that is what my right honourable friend, the Scottish Secretary, has been doing. And we have made the offer that we will devolve the power to hold that referendum so a referendum can be made in Scotland and held in Scotland. And frankly, I look forward to having the debate because I think that there have been too many in the SNP who are happy to talk about the process. They're happy to talk about the process. They don't want to talk about the substance. I sometimes feel when I listen to them, it's not a referendum they want, it's a neverendum. Well, question, let's have the debate and let's keep our country together.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Alex Salmond has taken to the airways and he's conceding nothing.
This has to be a referendum made, built, run in Scotland. The mandate that the SNP has to hold this referendum is unanswerable. That's the political reality. And the second thing is, perhaps, you know, we've done a bit more thinking about this than the Westminster government. And we know, for example, and we've just passed the consultation document we'll be launching in a couple of weeks' time, that the date for the referendum has to be the autumn of 2014.
So, Stuart Hosey, were you and your fellow SNP members surprised to hear David Cameron suddenly telling you that he wanted to have this referendum happen sooner rather than later?
Yeah, well, the timing was bizarre. And the nature of the intervention, as you said yourself, Tom, you know, Cameron wanting to have the referendum on his terms was almost designed to get the reaction which it got, which was, you know, a general acceptance in the commentariat that Alec played a blinder. He'd blundered into something he didn't realise. And we've seen in the last few days SNP membership shoot up. The website crashed because of the interest and support for independence up in the polls today. So I think it was a mistake all round on Cameron's part, a catastrophic mistake. And I think it'll augur well for the independence campaign.
Martin, there seems to be two interesting questions here that are a bit separate. First of all, do you think Cameron was entitled to weigh in the way he did? And secondly, was he smart?
Well, I don't think he did it well. I mean, Stuart's right. I mean, clearly, in the short term, at any rate, who knows about the long term, but in the short term, he made a fool of himself in Scotland. He allowed the SNP to attack him as a neo-Thatcher intervener in Scottish affairs. That always plays well, and that, you know, so that's bad for Cameron. On the other hand, I think that what's happened this week is kind of more interesting in the long term, because really the big issue is now out in the field in a way that it hasn't been until now. There's been a kind of paralysis on this question since May 2011, certainly as far as Westminster politics is concerned, obviously not so much in Holyrood, but the what's happened now is that the whole UK is engaged on this question, and it's a much more fluid political battle than it was before. Now, I'm not saying that that means automatically that the SNP are going to win this one, though they might, but I think it's the kind of precondition for the real thing. And we're now into the real thing. How long it's going to take, you know, when the vote's going to take place, 2013, 14, 15 or 16, who knows exactly, but the game's afoot.
But the one really crucial detail, I mean, there are details about timing and about, you know, the exact wording, which of course it'd be important to get fair. But the really important thing is what the options are, isn't it? Because if you just have a yes and no, then we know that on the current polling, even after what Stuart says is a recent tick up in the interest for independence, it would be likely to be a no. But if you had some kind of a middle way of a bit more independence without full independence, the game would be quite different.
Yes, I mean, that's this option called Devo Max, which means really essentially conceding fiscal independence to Scotland within a United Kingdom which retains authority in foreign and defence matters and some other things too. And British institutions would also remain in Scotland in that context. I mean, this is an idea that's, you know, had a lot of traction within part of the SNP. If you follow these debates, it's largely come from within the SNP, but it's been responded to, and it responds in its turn to a lot of talk in other political circles in Scotland about the adequacy, inadequacy of the devolution settlement of the late 90s and the way that the economic crisis is playing out in Scotland in particular.
That's actually a really important point. You know, the Liberal Party have been a federalist party for 100 years. They call it Home Rule. We know there's a body of opinion within the Labour Party that wants to move way beyond where we currently are, but short of independence. And we even had the ex-Tory presiding officer of the Scottish Parliament this week calling for more tax-raising powers. So I'm slightly at a loss to understand, in terms of the real debate, why the anti-independence parties aren't prepared to coalesce around something which is self-evidently close to many of their members' policies.
You're right. Cameron's made a bad mistake. I mean, the idea that from Westminster you say you can't put on the ballot paper the option that probably most people want. I mean, that's unthinkable. Not just unthinkable in Scotland, but you'd think if you ask most people across the UK, is that a fair way to conduct a referendum? They'd say no. And you're only going to have overwhelming opinion polls in Scotland, and Cameron will have to give in. In the end, you have to give in to public opinion on these things. And Cameron's put himself the wrong side of the argument. For those on the left, this is all a very interesting debate. We sit there, those of us on the left of centre, looking at Scotland with increasing envy, wishing we were Scots, wishing we could vote SNP too, but at the same time begging them not to go. Don't leave us alone. Don't desert us. Please don't go.
You see, Paula, you were doing so well. The point you made about the legitimacy of public opinion is really the key point that's being ignored, because we in the SNP, the Scottish Government, has a mandate to hold this referendum. And I think you're absolutely right. Cameron may well be forced to concede a second question simply because of the overwhelming demand for it. Now, we'll see where that comes from. We'll see how resistant the political parties are. But I suspect Civic Scotland is going to say, no, we want this Devo Max option tested on the ballot paper.
Is there no sense from our brethren and our sisters in Scotland that you should not leave England to its miserable fate of being dominated,
Polly,
by the Conservative Party forever?
It,
don't do it to us.
I've always thought it would be wrong for the Scottish people to usurp the democratic will of the English nation. Now, if there was an English Social Democratic Party you could vote for comfortably, then of course we'd be happy to support it, but I'm struggling to see where it is, particularly after Ed Miliband's relaunch this week.
All right, enough of this glee about England's problems, Stuart. Remind us, was this Devo Max thing in your manifesto? Was it clear before the election that we were talking about a multi-option referendum?
We were very clear, even in the last parliament, which was a minority parliament, that if we were able to get the referendum bill through, we were more than happy with the second question. So this is entirely consistent with what we've been saying for many, many years. We want that option tested against public opinion, as well as independence question that the SNP will campaign and vote for.
We're jumping a few bridges here. I mean, what Devo Max means is a question to which not everybody is agreed. I mean, it can mean a lot of things, and there's a debate to be had about that in a lot of respects. I mean, if you ask people, here are two extremes and here's a third way in the middle, a lot of people say, well, oh, I think the third way sounds like the best way because, you know, it's not extreme. So there's a bit of that behind the support for Devo Max, it seems to me. But in the end, the crucial question that's on the ballot paper is what's inside the can? And I don't think yet we know what's inside the can.
That's precisely why we've always said either the political parties or Civic Scotland needs to coalesce around a credible, viable Devo Max full fiscal autonomy option. You know, we can't define that for others, but I'm, as I said earlier, at a loss to understand why they won't define it for themselves when it does seem a rather sensible thing to do.
Well, I mean, there is some interest in it, isn't there? As you say, I mean, both historically and now in other parties, and there's activity going on in the Labour Party on these questions, which is really worth following because, you know, I think parts of Labour want to be part of this debate. Certainly parts of the Liberal Democrats want to be part of this debate. And, I think there's some very interesting calculations that are going to be
Labour
made
should certainly
over the over
support
time
the Devo Max option. If it looks half reasonable and half doable, Labour should strain every muscle it can to get with the SNP behind, well, the SNP but somewhere else, but in fact behind Devo Max. It would help Labour in Scotland and help Labour. It would help Labour in England too.
I think that makes sense, and that's why I'm perplexed when Labour have said this week they can't even talk about devolution until, as they put it, the independence question is resolved. That seems very short-sighted, that they can't say, well, we're opposed to one thing, but here's a positive alternative. And that's the real problem with the anti-independence campaign. There is no positive vision for the union, devolved or otherwise. There's just a negative picture of what we've proposed so far. And that, I think that's damaging for the No campaign.
As the crunch gets nearer on all of this, obviously one thing that would come sharply into focus is an economic argument. You know, would it really pay Scottish taxpayers to get this fiscal opt-out or not? But another one is potentially legal if Cameron is serious about saying you've got to set this question on our rules. Now, Stuart, if you respect the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, which I wouldn't assume, would you be prepared to take it all the way there?
Well, I think you're jumping so many hurdles. We are very confident in the legal position of a consultative referendum held by the Scottish Parliament. Indeed, Matt Quadrop yesterday said that the UK's assertion of illegality was against international law and against the protocols, the doctrine of UK referendums. So we're extremely comfortable with the legal position.
So this is this thing about them being consultative. Have they all been consultative?
Every referendum in the UK has been consultative. It's got the same basis as every other referendum. Now, if the UK government have a genuine concern about this and they want to do what they call a Section 30 transfer of powers, then let them do that. But we're going to have the referendum in the autumn of 2014, and I very much hope it will have the two options on the ballot paper. We are relaxed about the legal position about this.
That's quite an important thing Stuart said, I think, because I think the legal argument could become quite toxic if it's allowed to do so. And I think if both sides are willing to basically make a political deal on this that doesn't involve it having to go to the Supreme Court, I think that would probably be in most people's
best bet you
interest.
That's how it'll fetch out. This is about politics. Public opinion, when it is seen to be strongly one way in Scotland, Cameron will have to back down. It'd be absurd to go to the Supreme Court against an overwhelming vote in favour of the kind of referendum that the SNP are asking for.
The other thing, if one was cynical, you might say that the so-called legal question was simply the fig leaf for the interference. And I think that's the way it was portrayed, certainly in the media over the early part of this week.
Well, as you can hear, this issue, and like our discussion, is only just warming up. There's plenty more on our website at guardian.co.uk/Scotland. But closer to London, the government's controversial welfare reforms hit a snag this week, with three separate defeats in short order in the Lords last night over various plans to curb disability and sickness benefits. Polly, could you just quickly run us through what some of those votes were about?
Very emotional issues, some expensive, some not so expensive. First of all, young people, children who've been disabled all their life, on reaching adulthood, will have their benefits taken away. Outrageous. So they'll never have an independent income or a right to an independent income. The next one is cancer patients. You've got to get better or die within a year. And so they're saying, well, extend it for 2 years so that people have a chance to either get well or die. I don't know why cancer patients rather than other people. I don't know. And the third one is the employment support allowance, which is a contributory benefit which people have paid for through their national insurance. Instead of being entitled just for 1 year, you're entitled for 2 years. Again, a bit random, a bit arbitrary, but that's the expensive, more expensive one. None of them incredibly expensive, but and the government have actually dissembled with the figures. They've said it's 1.6 billion, but it's over 5 years, which makes it rather less.
So they're hyping it up a bit, but still it's a few hundred million. It's kind of serious money. Martin, you've watched the House of Lords for quite a while. How exceptional is it for the government to be beaten thrice in one night like this?
It's still quite unusual, but the government does get beaten in the House of Lords on quite a regular basis. All governments do. It's nothing. The Labour government got beaten more than the coalition is being beaten. But I mean,
and
it's
even
added,
over these spending things, like policy.
Well, this is substantive. I mean, this is that I think is the interesting and important thing is that you've got basically parties that are not really willing in the Lords to obey what their party leaderships in the Commons are insisting that they do. And so it's a much more freewheeling, independent mood in the Lords, and people aren't just going to take it. And, it's going to be a difficult question for the government as to how to come back on this. I mean, experience suggests they'll make some concessions and hold on to some of the things that they think are important. I doubt if they'll give way on everything. Polly will know the detail of this, and so will you better than I do.
Stuart, you're a whip. Would you fancy going back if you were Nick Clegg and co in the House of Commons and telling Lib Dem MPs that they'd got to vote to take money off cancer patients after a year?
I think if I'd had anything to do with government, coalition government at all, and someone had suggested a change to the benefit system for young disabled people and recovering cancer victims, I'd have told them you were going to get a rebellion on day one. And not to be so stupid, I was incredibly pleased what the Lords did. Let's see if the coalition listen. This can't just be about money. There are issues of fairness in this, and these original proposals were dreadfully unfair.
But of course, it is about money, isn't it? I mean, if money's no longer going to be saved from cancer patients, it's got to probably be saved at some point down the track from someone else.
Well, let's scrap Trident, shall we, and make sure our cancer recoverers are looked after properly.
OK. And finally, Polly, this isn't the end of the matter, is it? There's a few more chunks of this.
Big one next Tuesday. Next Tuesday is the Disability Living Allowance being changed to something called PIP, which is another unfortunate name at the moment because the same name is breast implants. And it's about as corrosive. It's taking large sums of money, again, off families with children. The very most disabled get a bit more children, but the great majority of families with disabled children lose virtually everything. And that's appalling because they need the money for extra mobility, for care, or if you want to use a nursery or childcare, costs a lot more if you've got a disabled child. It's a shocker, but it's a lot of money, a great deal of money, and that one will really hurt if there's a rebellion on that. But there should be. You ask most people in the street, who would you protect first? And however right-wing they are, they'd say, oh, I think disabled children. And they've been targeted.
Well, so there's a lot more to come. And if you want to follow it all, we've got a live blog dedicated now to welfare reform on The Guardian's website, where you can follow all the pending votes. Now, the release of The Iron Lady across cinemas nationwide has seen the former Tory leader get the Meryl Streep treatment.
Where there is discord, may we bring harmony. Shoulders back, tummies in.
She heads the most hated government this country has known.
The knives are out.
We can't possibly buckle at the first sign of difficulty.
No one is saying we have to buckle.
Yes, the medicine is harsh, but the patient requires it.
One must be careful not to test one's colleagues' loyalties.
Cowardice. The Falkland Islands belong to Britain, and I want them back.
If we are going, we have to go now.
We will stand on principle, or we will not stand at all.
With all due respect, when one has been to war...
With all due respect, sir, I have done battle every single day of my life.
Now, Polly, you've seen it. What did you think?
I saw it on a very curious occasion when about 10 senior women journalists were invited along to see it on the idea that we would think it was a wonderfully feminist movie. And it is, in the sense that it is a mythical story, largely, of this amazing woman who trounces every man in her path, whether it's the wets in her cabinet, whether it's the miners, whether it's poll tax revolters, whether it's the Argies and Galtieri. You just have ranks of men being trampled underfoot by this magnificent Boadicea. And any young person who was only mildly interested in politics seeing this film would think it's like seeing a film about Gloriana. It's a, like a wonderful celebration, Queen Victoria, a wonderful celebration of a great woman in our past. No politics in it, zero. No analysis of, in any way, of what she left behind or what the cost was for many of the things she did. And the fact that, and I said to the filmmakers at the time, the fact that when she came to power, only one in seven children was poor. Within a few years, it was one in three children, and it's barely shifted since then. That is deep social damage, never mentioned.
I guess in any film where you've got a protagonist who's kind of steadfast, which, I mean, and people could quibble about whether Thatcher was really as steadfast at the beginning as she later became, but it's a kind of heroic trait, isn't it? And she was almost bound to come out of it well, in that she was resolute in what she did.
Sometimes if you want to make a good film and a good story, you have to entirely distort history, because it makes a nice, neat narrative. In fact, she was a bit more pragmatic. She was also good at some things, not at others, right on some things, not on others. You're not going to get that in a movie of that kind. So I thoroughly disliked the movie, though Meryl Streep was brilliant and it's beautifully directed, but I really hated it.
I kind of quite enjoyed it, although more as a study in dementia rather than as a study in history. But away from the multiplex and back in the Palace of Westminster, it's been another character that's been under scrutiny since the new year. The question being asked is whether Ed Miliband has got what it takes. Now, Martin, there's been some rather personal kind of stuff in the media. The Times today has got a whole column on whether why Ed Miliband isn't fanciable. And, you know,
it's more about journalism than I think it does about politics. But
does it? Or do we have to just accept that character counts an awful lot?
Well, I think character, I would say personality would be the word I was happier with than character. I think it does matter. And Margaret Thatcher is proof incarnate that personality matters in politics, because, you know, she did things right and wrong as a result of her personality, which would not have happened if somebody else had been in the position that she was. So as to Ed Miliband, I think a lot of this is overdone. I think it's journalists with not enough to write about finding something to connect with. I think it also goes to the kind of tendency to trivialization within the media in this country, which is ever present. And actually, I think there are plenty of good serious issues about the Labour Party to write about and talk about and debate, rather than whether Ed Miliband's got a funny voice or looks weird. And of course, individuals do matter in politics. That's why particular people get chosen to be leaders and not. It's why Tony Blair became leader of the Labour Party and not Gordon Brown in 1994. Whether that was right or wrong, the individual did matter in that context, and, you know, you can't get away from it. But I think it's part of the demeaning of our political culture that this is such a big issue.
Stuart, I mean, you're an outsider to Miliband's tribe, obviously, but you've looked on from a distance a few Labour leaders now. I mean, is he much different from what went before?
I agree. This is about trivialisation. I'm more concerned with his policy and his performance, because it's the performance that counts as well. And the relaunch this week seemed to be one of those interminable speeches where he delivers one-sentence paragraphs that no one can understand what it means. And then we get the PMQs this week. He goes on the rail fares, two very anemic questions about Scotland, hid from the economy again. And I think far more important than his character or nature or personality is the fact that he keeps letting the Tories off the hook on the economy, which speaks more about the dearth of Labour policy than it does about any weakness in his character.
Well, let's just listen to a clip from him here, because, I mean, he claimed he was talking about the economy this week.
Whoever governs after 2015 will have to find more savings. That has profound implications, not just for our country, but for my party as well. It means that the Blair-Brown approach of the past will not be enough.
Polly, you listened, didn't you? Was there anything in this, do you think?
I think it was indicating a new sense of direction. There's been a mythology, really, that social democratic policies, politics, have had it right across Europe. They're all dead because their only party's any good for spending money and no good in hard times. And I think he's beginning to bring round to the view that actually in the hard times, your priorities matter much more because they're far more painful. When there's less money, it really matters
socialism.
What choices you make. Absolutely the religion of socialism. And now he's got to start doing some of those tough choices. So far, that's been rather timid. You know, 5 billion off defence? You know, you could take 35 billion off defence and never notice. There are lots of things that are there to be done. There are lots of priorities to be changed. Who is suffering most? Well, not people in the top 10%. The people suffering most are the people in the bottom 50%. So there are discussions to be had about where the burden should fall, on who, on what issues. And I think he's tiptoeing. He hasn't got time in a feeding frenzy like this. A bit wobbly on the bicycle. He needs to pedal faster.
But he's kind of got an outline of an agenda that's fairly clear now, isn't it? He's in a conference speech, some more moralised capitalism, and then he's talking about more responsible companies, maybe changes to company law and crackdowns on energy companies that rip off pensioners was a big thing in the speech. But it feels a bit bitty, and isn't he very isolated in that? Shouldn't he have shadow cabinet members coming forward and explaining what, you know, what it means in their own area? And that's not happening, is it?
Think how much difference it would have made if straight after his conference speech, every single one of his or the relevant shadow cabinet ministers had been out there saying, yes, what predatory capitalism means, what good capitalism means in my patch, and had reiterated the theme, making it real in policy context in their own departments and repeating it. You don't get the feeling that there is that kind of grid, that kind of organisation. He's now got somebody new in charge of his office who used to work for the Archbishop of Canterbury, not sure if that's a good recommendation or not.
But not as maybe, far as you're concerned.
Well, what I mean is one doesn't think of the Archbishop of Canterbury as being a finely honed fighting weapon. But we shall see.
I think, Polly, the point that you made there about shadow cabinet ministers coming out and backing him after a conference speech is interesting. But the whole point about it is the policy was ludicrous. How can you be a centrist social democratic party supporting a mixed economy if your leader says something which can be interpreted as believing half our businesses are evil? I think that whole idea was just wrong. Of course there are bad companies, but there are laws there already to deal with bad companies. I think that
shouldn't there be some more laws?
But Cameron has used much fiercer language this week. I mean, not just crony capitalism, but phrase after phrase, much tougher than anything Ed Miliband dared say.
Indeed, but Ed Miliband came out and it struck me that whole predatory capitalism, bad capitalism versus good capitalism stuff was half-baked. It wasn't thought through. And that's what I was meaning earlier. The policy stuff is far too thin.
I agree with that. And I think that's why it didn't, what Polly wanted to happen didn't happen, because it was a phrase and, it's an idea in a seminar or a focus group rather than something that was actually worked through in concrete policy terms. And I think that's the criticism I would make of Ed Miliband, is that he doesn't show leadership. You know, if you're going to do these things, you have to do it properly. You have to do it thoroughly, as Archbishop Laud said 400 years ago. And what you have to do, he was an Archbishop of Canterbury, by the way. He knew what he was about and got executed as a result. I mean, the real point here, I think, is that Ed Miliband is intermittent in his leadership. He was brave in challenging his brother. He was pretty brave in attacking Murdoch and News International. He was original in what he said in his conference speech. But I can't think of any other particularly memorable moment in his leadership career. And I just think Stuart's party, I'm not going to I'm quite critical of Stuart's party, but it's a really well organised party. It's a real kind of vanguardist party with lots of people who know what they all stand for. They go out and do it. It's a very disciplined outfit, and you know that's one of the reasons that because they're very organised and effective, and they talk to people before they do it.
Too many flaky Blairites who are kind of undermining Ed as he goes along.
I disagree with that. I think that's just a fantasy.
But in terms of the SNP versus Labour, without being partisan, because we have policy, because we had something substantive to say this week, we found that even on Channel 4 News, for example, Ed Miliband's relaunch didn't even make the running order because the Scottish story was much stronger because there were real things to say. And you know, I think that typifies the lack of policy strength. Miliband made a long speech, but there was nothing really in it.
It's a long run into the next election, and he's right that he could be throttled by hard policies he produces now that seem irrelevant in 2 years' time. It's a tricky one to run. Cameron was running miles behind his party, not doing well at this stage of his leadership. When he first became leader, don't write him off.
Well, hearteningly, we've brought it back to the issues, as Tony Benn used to say, rather than personalities. So we've done our bit to repurify politics. My thanks to Stuart Hosey, Polly Toynbee and Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.